they've been trying to make the film for a long time. I think the film had been optioned in like 76. The book was written in 75. And just was sitting at home and thought, well, I saw it on my shelf and I thought, why hasn't it been made? And it was a particular favourite book of mine when I was a kid. And I'd kind of dipped in and out of Ballard, you know, subsequently. But when I went back and reread it, it felt like it was incredibly prescient. It fitted in with that kind of predictive, kind of dystopian fiction. But when I reread it, it felt like it had happened. And I think that was the moment I kind of thought, well, this would be really interesting to kind of make it as a movie. But obviously, just dipping into your own bookshelf and pulling books off the side and hoping to make them is quite random.
That was director Ben Wheatley there discussing his new film, High Rise, a dystopian satire set in 1970s London. We'll hear from him shortly. Also ahead, 50 years after In Cold Blood, Truman Capote's groundbreaking work of non-fiction. We'll talk to the chief prosecutor in the case and ask whether our views of true crime stories have changed. Plus,
I could see that the chemistry between Gemma and Gary was perfect for a documentary and would be hilarious and would make a great film.
We'll touch down at this year's South by Southwest Festival in Texas. And later in the show, filmmaker Alexander Ulch fulfills a lifelong dream as he unveils the newest entrant in New York's art house scene, the Metrograph.
We've had remarkably stylish audiences and remarkably, frankly, romantic audiences. And that's a way that I've always thought about this project from the very beginning, was that this is a place that you can actually go on a date to the movies.
That's all to come on The Cinema Show, your culture guide to the world of film on Monocle 24. Hello, I'm Ben Ryland. We're at the Picture House Central Cinema in London's Piccadilly Circus today. We've just finished a screening of the new film High Rise, a seedy spectacle that takes us inside the bizarre world of a 1970s brutalist apartment dwelling. The film is based on J.G. Ballard's novel from 1975, which reimagines how the perfect modern skyscraper, thoughtfully designed to cater to every human need, unwittingly awakens an uncontrollable desperation for chaos. Director Ben Wheatley is here today. He is, of course, the man behind Kill List in 2011 and Down Terrace back in 2009 as well, which you can catch on Mubi at the moment. He's just about to start a Q&A session with Picture House's Paul Ridd. Let's have a listen.
Would you like to start by telling us a little bit about the genesis of this project? Obviously, you've made four films prior to High Rise, and each in a different register, a different genre, and different scale. This feels like the biggest film you've made to date in terms of the scale, the cast, the sort of ambition of it. Where did it begin?
I came into it through the film had been they've been trying to make the film for a long time. I think the film had been optioned in like 76. The book was written in 75. Yeah, and so it'd been around for a long time, and they'd been trying to get it made, and I had no idea about any of this. So I basically came to it kind of a year or so before production and just was sitting at home and thought, well, you know, I saw it on my shelf and I thought, why hasn't it been made? And it was a particular favourite book of mine when I was a kid. And I'd kind of dipped in and out of Ballard, you know, subsequently. But when I went back and reread it, it felt like it was incredibly prescient. And that from what I'd read before, when I'd read it in the kind of late 80s, early 90s, it was quite close to when it had been written, and it felt like it fitted in with that kind of predictive, kind of dystopian fiction. But when I reread it, it felt like it had happened. And I think that was the moment I kind of thought, well, this would be really interesting to kind of make it as a movie. But obviously, just dipping into your own bookshelf and pulling books off the side and hoping to make them is quite random. And we never thought, basically, how it usually works is you do that and then you get a right search on it and try and find out if anyone's got it. And usually they have. You know, most novels have been bought up by Hollywood. I mean, they don't just even buy books, they buy authors or they buy whole genres now. You know, and it's just a kind of total clearance of all kind of cultural products. So I didn't hold out much hope, you know, that it was available. But it was, and it was and it was being held by Jeremy Thomas, who produced Crash and Naked Lunch, amongst many, many other movies. And it all moved very quickly from there. You know, within 3 days of kind of re-looking at the book, I was talking to Jeremy, and that was the start of it.
And in terms of the sort of writing process, obviously the book being close to your heart, one that was kind of formative, what was the approach there? Obviously, you're collaborative with Amy Jump. Did you sort of go through line by line? Was it quite a sort of torturous process of being as faithful as possible?
Or according to the BBC yesterday, I allowed Amy Jump to write the script.
Strange terminology.
Yeah, I think it's because we're married and it's like there's some kind of weird mega sexism going on, or that they felt that it, because it's a 70s book, that they thought it was appropriate to talk about it in a kind of 70s sexist kind of way, you know. And it's not really how we work, you know. I love the image of like the kind of the director in his smoking jacket stalking about, kind of like ripping pages out of the book going, here you go, this is going to be great, you know. And it's not like that at all, you know. I have no contact with her while she writes. I'm just a massive irritation. And it's dangerous even to ask how it's going, I've found. You just keep your head down and hope that it's going to get finished at some point, which it was really quickly. And then I read it and I thought it was great. But I don't then write her a load of notes and tell her what to do. I would never do that. I'd be too afraid. And that's always been our, you know, we've been together since we were like 16, so I kind of, that's our relationship, working relationship has always been like that. So yeah, that was it. You know, my big creative moment on the project was pulling the book off the shelf. But she won't come out and she won't do Q&As and she won't do press or anything. So it always looks like I take all the credit. But all the movies we've done together are much more, you can see that they're movies made by a couple.
In terms of the sort of scale of the film and the kind of palette that you're dealing with and the huge cast that you've assembled, I wonder, with this film, was there more of a kind of storyboarding process? Was that, because obviously you've got so many different locations, so many different quite ambitious constructed shots, was this very kind of meticulously storyboarded, or is that?
Yeah, I mean, I used to think it was really weak as a director to storyboard, because you should be able to visualize it on the spot. But I've increasingly storyboarded everything, you know, in the last couple of projects, because it's just too much to wing it and it's not fair on anybody, you know. And also I tend to draw everything myself and then draw every scene, not just action, but every dialogue scene, every page of the script, so that I can kind of, it forces me to think about the unsexy bits, like transitions between scenes, or, and also it allows me to communicate with the art department and costume department and makeup visually, rather than trying to translate that into words and then back, which is always, there's always a gap there. But if you can draw it, then you can, it's a much quicker form of communication basically for film, I think.
I feel like in your previous films you've obviously been using real locations for the most part, and with this film there's so much that seems to, you know, have involved the soundstage and involved like lots of very elaborate post-production. Was that a very sort of different process, or was it just working with actors in the same way as you've
No, I mean, we had the idea, Laurie Rose, the DOP, and I, of like wanting to shoot on location in the past. So we built the sets. The sets all had ceilings on them, so they weren't like sound stages with loads of lights above them like you imagine like a set is. It was all just, we built all the sets as rooms, and then in the other movies we'd have shot with what's called available light, which is like whatever you can get from outside. And in this one we just faked the available light. So we shot it in exactly the same way as we shot all the films. We were worried about it at the beginning, that we didn't want to get too far away from our working process from the other movies, and unless we, in case we kind of lost touch with how we'd got to that position. Yeah, and that was important to us.
We'll return to the Picture House to hear more from Ben Wheatley a little later in the show. And I should also mention that Wheatley's 2009 crime drama, Down Terrace, is screening on Mubi here in the UK from the 19th, alongside another crime film from an entirely different world. On the evening of November 15, 1959, Perry Smith and Richard Hickok entered the home of the Clutter family, just outside the US town of Holcomb in the state of Kansas. They'd been told of a safe full of cash, but soon after arriving realized that they'd been misled, and they proceeded to murder all four family members in the home. If this all sounds familiar, that's because the crime provided the basis for Truman Capote's classic 1966 book, In Cold Blood. And the following year, it became a film.
Gentlemen, four of your neighbors were slaughtered like hogs in a pen by them. They did not strike suddenly in the heat of passion, but for money. They did not kill in vengeance. They planned it for money. And how cheaply those lives were bought.
Now, movie subscribers here in the UK can catch 1967's In Cold Blood from director Richard Brooks. It's playing now. But 50 years after the publication of Capote's groundbreaking work of non-fiction, how have our views on the art of true crime drama evolved? Duane West is the prosecutor who worked on the case, winning their conviction and subsequent death sentences. He joins me now on the line from Kansas. Duane, thank you very much for joining us. I do appreciate it. When you first began working on the case, did you have any sense at all that what you were seeing here was something that might resonate in the way that it ultimately did?
We had no idea that it was going to turn into that big a thing. Back in 1959 when that happened, of course out here it was a big deal because the Clutter family were prominent people, but at that time in our history, when four people got killed, that was big news, and not only here but elsewhere. The, of course, matter caught Capote's eye because of a little squib that appeared in one of the Eastern papers, because Mr. Clutter had been appointed to some kind of a national agricultural board by President Eisenhower, and that's why it appeared in the Eastern press. And, of course, we had no idea the time it happened here that he was going to come out here and get involved in it, and but we were of course very busy because it was a shock to everybody here and all over our state and the surrounding states because of the brutality of the murders and just the fact that it had happened. And we were besieged by all sorts of people who were wondering what happened, how it happened, who'd done it, and we were going to catch them, blah 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 blah, you know. So I don't recollect how long it was before actually Capote showed up on the scene. But there were scads and scads of news agencies and papers that sent people out here, you know, after the thing happened to get more information about it.
Now, when we talk about true crime stories, I suppose it can be easy to put a certain gap between us and the real crime and all of the details that go with it. With that in mind, how do you feel about In Cold Blood and its depiction of something that you would know quite a lot better than most people?
Well, I, of course, was the chief prosecutor of the case and the elected county attorney at the time. And, of course, by law in Kansas, the county attorney is the chief law enforcement officer in the county. The KBI, of course, came in and assisted our local sheriff's office with the case. And, you know, ultimately we got it solved, and we actually arrested the killers in 45 days, which was pretty excellent job considering how bad a crime it was. But actually, I tell people, you know, when you don't get the hero of the piece right, you know, I can't think it's a very good book. And Capote didn't get the hero right. And is he a good salesman? Oh, heck yes, a good salesman, because we've traveled around over the world some, and we met a fellow back in 1993, when we visited the Asian Rim countries. We met him in Jakarta, and he was an Aussie, and he was running a school there for teaching English, and had been for 17 years. And when we met him, I knew from his accent that he was either an Aussie or a New Zealander or from the UK. And when I asked him where he's from, he said, well, he's from Australia. And he said, where are you from? And we said, well, we're from Kansas. And he said, honest to God, this is what he said. He said, well, the only thing I know about Kansas is In Cold Blood. Well, I just happened to have in my pocket one of my legal cards, Duane E. West, attorney at law, Garden City, Kansas, and I took it out of my pocket and gave it to him. And I said, well, I was the chief prosecutor. And I thought he was going to faint dead away, you know. So, you know, it became known worldwide because of Capote's efforts. But, you know, like I say, he got the hero wrong. And so I have a signed copy of his book, but I've never read it and don't intend to. So, you know, that's just my assessment of Mr. Capote's piece, according to people who I've talked to who have read it, said, well, it was a sympathy piece for the killers. And I don't have a bit of sympathy for those two, you know. I made the decision to ask the jury for the death penalty, and I'm the only person that could do that since I was the elected county attorney, and I'm not sorry. I would have gone and sprung the trap if the state would have asked me to.
Dwayne West, thank you very much for chatting today. No matter how aspiring or accomplished you might be, most films require at least a little bit of good fortune if they're going to get off the ground. Co-director Steve Reed first met British pop star Gary Numan backstage after a concert, and that was where he casually asked him if he could make a film about him. Now, what followed was an intimate journey over several years into the heart of a man who reached his zenith in the late 1970s and 80s while battling Asperger's and depression. Gary Numan, Android in La La Land, is Reed's second feature. He worked on the project with Rob Alexander, getting right to the heart of his passion and talent and examining in sometimes comic detail his relationship with his wife Gemma. Ed Stocker caught up with Reed after a screening of the film at the South by Southwest Festival in Austin, Texas.
I think when you meet the right subject of a film, you tend to know, well, I tend to know really quickly that it's the right person and they're good for a film. You know, the story's got legs, the narrative's got legs, characters are engaging enough, and obviously they've got an interesting backstory. When I met Gary, it didn't take very long for me to sort of like blurt out, oh, I want to make a film about you. Which is exactly what happened. It was backstage at a festival in 2012, and he'd just been playing on stage, and I hadn't, you know, I'm not a Gary Numan fan really. I kind of am now, but I wasn't at the time, so I didn't really know much about him. But I was, I saw the show, and I was absolutely blown away by his performance and by the music. He was playing a lot of the classics, but with a very sort of modern, sort of heavier guitar-based versions of those songs, and. Yeah, and I loved it, and you know, like I say, it took me just a few minutes really of being with him, just found him really fascinating. And on top of that, I could see that the chemistry between Gemma and Gary was perfect for a documentary and would be hilarious and would make a great film. So we moved on from there, and I went and found out stuff about him, found out about his story, his backstory, and you know, his huge fame back in the at the end of the 70s, early 80s, and his you know, demise after that. You know, he kind of hit rock bottom, almost bankruptcy, and his slow rise back. Yeah, so I read up about him, and then we met up again about a week later and did some test shots, and then I convinced Rob Alexander, who I'd made a film with for Channel 4 actually previously to that, that had just come out, convinced Rob that we had a great, you know, a great story here and a great potential film. Yeah, it's really multi-layered. So you've got that huge backstory of his huge fame and his the rise and fall and kind of rise again. You know, set against this move to the States, the recording of the new album, and then all this other stuff started coming out, which I didn't even know about, you know, the depression, which is, you know, it's amazing to have someone of Gary's stature talking about depression. You know, it's an important subject for men to talk about. So that all that came out. Also, the Asperger's condition that Gary has, that all came out in the film. And then and lots of other really beautiful, intimate moments between Gary and Gemma, and a huge amount of, you know, laughs and, you know, just banter and stuff. So it has a number of layers to it, all of which are pretty strong on their own.
Obviously, Gary Numan, very well known in the late 70s and early 80s, you know, within those certain music-loving circles. Was there ever a concern that it would only appeal as a film to a certain generation or a certain type of music lover? Were you concerned that maybe younger people wouldn't be so drawn to it?
I think we believed, actually, that we weren't going to have that problem, because we had two really engaging characters, really funny characters that will give us a film that has crossover appeal. And we kind of knew that fairly soon on. Obviously, we wanted to talk about Gary's music. He's hugely influential. And, you know, we love the stuff he's done. But it needed to be more than a music doc. We want everyone to watch it. We want, you know, teenagers to watch it. We want older people to watch it. We want non-music fans to go and watch it and love it. And I think, you know, that's going to... I'm really confident that's going to happen.
It makes me want to ask you what you're planning on next.
Yeah, I'm planning two other ideas. Well, working on two other ideas at the moment, which I've kind of had, you know, in my mind for a year or so. Actually, this film Android and La La Land took a little bit longer to finish than we'd expected for a number of reasons. But so these ideas have kind of just been ticking around in my head. And yeah, hopefully now, I mean, this will open up doors, no doubt, if it's as successful as we all hope it and think it will be. And that will help, obviously, move these next projects on. So I won't say what they are yet, but they're going to be exciting projects to work on, no doubt.
Monocle's Ed Stocker there, chatting to Steve Reed, co-director of the documentary Gary Newman, Android in La La Land. Still to come on The Cinema Show, we'll head to New York's newest arthouse institution, the Metrograph, and more from director Ben Wheatley and his new film, High Rise.
Get ready for the latest in our brilliant new series with the Monocle Travel Guide to Hong Kong. There is much more to Hong Kong than its sea of skyscrapers. It's a global hub that welcomes visitors, and you should be next. We'll point you where to go if you're in the mood for bao or burgers, and where to stay if you want to get away from the centre of town. There are runs and hikes to refresh you after a long flight, plus essays from Hong Kongers who have witnessed the city's drastic changes over the past decade. Published by Gestalten, our travel guides are for people who want to get the most out of their stay and feel like locals rather than tourists in the world's great cities. The Monocle Travel Guide to Hong Kong. Cities are fun. Let's explore.
This is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24 in association with MUBI, the curated movie site of cult, classic, and award-winning films. Now, you might think that being accomplished in the worlds of fashion, writing, and filmmaking would be quite enough for any hungry mind. For Alexander Ulch, however, that was all just the beginning of a much larger dream. Swinging open its doors for the first time this month, New York's Metrograph Cinema is a cleverly curated hub for film purists. Being the passion project of an actual filmmaker no doubt helps to create some of the wonderful ambience that the theatre has so successfully mastered. Monocle's Megan Billings sat down with Alexander in the Metrograph's beautiful wooden-backed chairs to hear about how his dream of running a cinema blossomed into one of the city's finest screening destinations.
Well, I grew up on this island and fell in love with making movies in large part because of the places that I went to see them when I was little. Places like the Beekman, the Plaza, the Ziegfeld, which are now literally all gone. And one part of this idea was to try to reclaim some of that special glamour magic that I'd felt as a little boy going to those places, where even before the movie started, you could feel that something special happened inside. The other part of this idea is that this is a place you would really come to even if you weren't going to see a movie. And that is something I had not felt in the city, is to have a place with our bookstore, our candy store, two bars, restaurant, that this is a place where people are going to come open for breakfast and lunch and have meetings, write their screenplays, be a part of a movie experience that extends beyond the actual cinema rooms.
I was speaking to one of your colleagues a moment ago, and he said something very interesting, that part of this is reclaiming that magic of kind of going to the theater, what that used to be that is in some ways lost now, but also building something that's a way forward and what people want to experience when they do go to the cinema. So can you talk to me about that?
Well, I was very, very excited when I saw we opened the theater about 10 days ago. So we're about on the 11th day in. We had a 11 p.m. screening of Masculin Femina, and I was thrilled to see what basically was a packed house of dates. And people, very, I have to say, stylish group of people. I was not necessarily expecting that at a repertory cinema. And we've had remarkably stylish audiences and remarkably, frankly, romantic audiences. A lot of dates happening here. And that's a way that I've always thought about this project from the very beginning, was that this is a place that you can actually go on a date to the movies, which I felt was starting to slip away a little bit in New York City. That there is something special about coming to see a film, and there are the finer details of the chair you sit in, the decor of the room, but the overall feeling of the place, what it stands for, the kind of programming that we do, that it's something that feels special that you might just get a little dressed up to come to.
I would love to talk about actually those finer details. Everything is incredibly beautiful. As you said, the chairs have a wooden back. The fonts that you used are beautiful. You can peek into the screening room upstairs. You have a beautiful balcony. Every detail is really wonderful. And talk to me about those choices that you made and just describe them to me.
Well, I guess, I mean, it's a strange project in the sense that I am a filmmaker and I've now designed a movie theater. So I've really approached this project, which has taken 6 years, really in the same way that I would a movie, which is the accumulation of massive amounts of detailed decisions from the chairs, which are made from the very same beams of the Domino Sugar Factory. So when they demoed the Domino Sugar Factory, we got our hands on the roof beams, and these chairs are hand milled into my own design of a chair. I was presented by architects and engineers catalogs of ready-made chairs, which I promptly closed those catalogs and said, I think we're going to do our own thing. Yeah, so the chairs are one particular idea. They, in there, we're sitting in them right now in Theater 2. The velvet armrest, the velvet back, and the velvet seats, combined with this old-growth pine, has a certain sense, I think, of glamour. At the same time, we're on a concrete floor, and there are some very honest details of being in a warehouse on Ludlow Street in Chinatown in Manhattan. And for me, a lot of the decisions here have been creating a world of contrasts, of trying to have key items that speak of a certain glamour from an era that maybe is gone, and ideas that are very much now that are sort of very simple. And so I guess you might call it a low-key glamour, sort of an honest glamour. So there's no real quotation marks here. It's not trying to be nostalgic just for the sake of nostalgia. It's simply trying to create a certain sense of formality and classiness about the space and excitement about the space from all of the details that we've created, from the type styles to the menus to the marquee, which is made of special wood letters with magnets, which was kind of a crazy design idea. Every single thing here, for better or worse, has been thought through very, very carefully.
Megan Billings there in conversation with the Metrograph's Alexander Ulch. We are back at the Picture House Central Theatre in London's Piccadilly now to hear more from Ben Wheatley, the director of the new film High Rise, and his live Q&A session with Picture House's Paul Ridd, and of course the audience here today as well. Let's have a listen.
I just wanted to know about you saying you storyboarded quite a lot before. How does that translate on the day of the shoot, and how much do you end up letting the actor sort of play, and how much of that actually ended up in the cut, if anything?
Well, the storyboards are there primarily to force me to draw and to think about many aspects of it. But also, I'm not the kind of director who forces the actors into a position and blocks it beforehand. And this has come out of this kind of Hitchcock idea of, like, he's already made the film before he starts, and which is fine, you know. But what I find with that is the more prescriptive you are with actors, the stiffer they get. And if you do this thing of, like, you know, it's directing, it's not telling, you know. So if you act it all out and then they have to do that, they'll only ever be as good as you are. And I'm shit at acting. That's why I hire really brilliant actors, otherwise I do it all myself, and I can't, because I'm terrible. So I have all these storyboards, and then I don't look at them on the day. They're not on set. And then you roll with the day. So then you see what the actors do in the space, see what the DOP does in the space, have all those conversations, technical conversations, that what's going to work and what's not. And you don't get too hung up on getting that exact thing. But then I find when I go back to the boards, they're pretty close to what I got. And I tend to storyboard like twice or three times as well. So I'll draw it all out once, put it away, draw it again, put it away. And through those things, it's like learning. So you're learning to visualize it and you hold it in your head. And then by the time you get to set, you should be able to just see it, but be flexible enough that if there's a curveball or it just you got it wrong, it doesn't completely sink you or sink your confidence in what you're doing.
And that's it for this week. Can art ever really get to the truth? Well, we all know what Truman Capote thought, but whether you're tucked away in your own high-rise, streaming some of your own favourite cinematic treats, or discovering the next art house extraordinaire at an independent screening house, I do hope that we've inspired you to dig a little deeper and to keep asking those questions. Today's show was edited by Nina Norick and researched by Yolene Goffin. Listen again and find out more over at monocle.com, and remember to subscribe to the podcast as well. The Cinema Show returns next week. I'm Ben Ryland. Thanks for listening.